Hello, everyone out there in webinar land. Bruce Merrifield here. And today, what you see is the overall agenda of 11 webinars. Today, we're going to do number 5, Net Profit Analytics Plays. You'll notice 1, 2, 3, 4. This is a little subset, little quartet of specific how-to plays. Note over here that if anybody wants a copy of all the slide decks for a customized webinar for a trade association or buying group or management team meeting, whatever, the answer is yes. This is just a list of sort of the 11 specific cookbook plays. There actually are more, but these are the sort of the better ones, I guess. And we're going to do this particular group here in webinar number 5. For webinar slides for this specific play or all of them, just email me, bruce@merrifield.com. Also, if you go to LinkedIn and search under my full name here, D. Bruce Merrifield Jr., I'd be happy to connect with you. But I post a lot of sort of curated things about oncoming electronic commerce, cloud stuff, and Amazon, et cetera. And so you can do that if you want. Okay, introductory points here. Let's see, what I'm sort of saying here initially is, you know, distributions, many distributors, depends on the channel, but a lot are sort of facing an existential crisis, you know, as far as this cloud e-commerce and how much of their business could be shredded, nibbled, chomped, you know, by digital disruptors, notably Amazon Business. But really the first thing is, you know, you've got to renew your profit power. Most distributors, their business is like a big old sailboat that's got a huge sail just riddled with holes that the wind passes through, and the hull is loaded with barnacles and there's seaweed on the rudder. So there's no boat speed. And if you don't have any boat speed, no free cash flow, you don't have any courage or money to reinvest in new channel business and e-selling models. And everybody's going to have to sort of innovate, you know, at the business model level. So anyway, this, you know, particular, you know, these net profit plays are all about that core customer profit renewal. So today we're going to talk about plays 6, 7, 8, high systemic credit return customers. There's some customers that just, you know, it's workaround. I don't know why, but they just, you know, they buy stuff and they return stuff like crazy. And as long as it's free returns, why not? So it generates enormous amounts of hidden activity costs, really, for both you and the customer, because we're giving them all this paperwork, and we'll look into that. Second one is sort of a next level idea of once you have net profitable customer profitability ranking reports, if you sort the top 100, 200 customers into piles, you're going to find that some groups of customers, niches of customers, you know, that all sort of buy the same one-stop shop assortment of stuff, because every customer buys a different array of items from you. And then looking for peculiar service metric needs that they have, figuring those out, measure them, achieving them, and then, you know, you've got something nobody else has. You dominate that most profitable niche. And then most distributors make a lot of money on direct ship quoting, you know, business and their opportunities there. So moving on, high systemic credit expense customers. You know, back in 1974, I jumped into my first distribution turnaround opportunity as a 24-year-old kid, and I went to the branch manager that was losing money, and he was beleaguered, and he was the fourth branch manager in like 6 years, and the company was chronically losing money, structurally, systematically, but we just kind of didn't know. It's like sell, 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 and maybe somehow economies of scale will lift us out of our losing streak. But if you're selling losing orders to losing customers and you keep doing it, you're just going to, you know, fine, you get bigger and losses get bigger. So I went to the guy and I said, look, I was visiting with some customers. They said our service stinks. How do I get my finger on the pulse, even approximation? He said, well, you know, usually we make a mistake. We create a credit, you know, because we mispriced it, we mispicked it, we shipped it short, it was damaged. We have to give them a credit. And hey, I'm so busy. Here's a huge pile. He gave me about 6 weeks worth of credits that he had to look at, authorize, and sign. He just didn't have time. Imagine you know, customer thinking, wait a minute, I complained about this 6 weeks ago and this garbage is still here and it hasn't been, you know, returned and I haven't got my credit. I mean, that's a bad service by itself. So I looked at this pile, I just started shuffling through them, and right away I noticed one customer that had a lot of credits. You know, and I said, well, geez, you know, it's the old, you know, 5%, 35%, you know, 5% of the customers, 35% of the credits, or some big power law. It's like, you know, not all customers are equal, average, and the same. So I dug a little deeper and found out that this customer, we delivered, you know, a couple skids of stuff to them 2 or 3 times a week on special skids. And the big customer had said the vendors would have to pay for and provide the skids. And so the customer said, I'm not paying for these new skids. The branch manager said, I'm not paying for them. The sales rep said, I'm not paying for them. So the solution was bill the customer for the skids. But when they gave us returnable ones, you know, we deliver three skids of stuff. They gave us 3 empty skids to take back. We would create a credit. So we're creating, you know, 2, 3 times 50. We're, you know, 150 credits a year for a cash flow event that had happened several years before. I mean, it's just stupid. It's like, hey, let's just stop this. And so that started getting me on my, you know, how many credits do we issue per 1,000 line items picked? You know, that was my innovation metric. And it never can be perfect. It just, you know, it puts me in the right ballpark and gets me working on stuff and experiments. And we went from about 70 screw-ups per 1,000 line items to less than 5 in about 5-6 weeks. So that was, but then I started thinking, well, you know, I wonder if we have other customers that have a lot of credits in proportion to their invoices. So I ranked all the customers by their credits divided by their invoices. And for example, at the top, there was one customer that had 15 invoices and they had 15 credits. And, you know, the whole overall average is less than 1%. And if you looked at the detail of it, he was claiming that every time we shipped him stuff, we shipped him short. In other words, he's cheating. And you know, when you have 1,000 customers and a lot of them are little desperate kind of people just working 100 hours a week cheating their taxes to sort of survive, you're going to find people like this. So it became known as the Rascal Ranking Report. But then you would find other things where there were just a lot of credits divided by in proportion to the invoices. And if you dug a little deeper, it was just dumb, you know, workarounds. Another subgroup was like, and that was like that first story I just told you. That was just a dumb workaround. I know we don't want to pay for the skids. Let's create $3,000, $4,000 of the paperwork on both sides, you know, kind of thing, perpetually. The third group here is, you know, if you're a contractor, particularly a contractor supply distributor, a lot of people come to your counter. And, you know, a guy comes in and says, gee, I got to do a job, and I think I need about 5 or 6 items to get the job done. Why don't I get 7 or 8 just in case? And what I don't need, I'll bring back tomorrow. And as long as there's free returns, we're going to have the picking costs, we have the return costs, and then we have the credit processing costs. And maybe this guy just throws a paper away because they're underground economy. They don't care, but we're getting killed on. And then a fourth group, you may come across this, particularly when you look at it at the rep level. I did find in my original turnaround one rep where they had a huge amount, and what they really were doing was quoting a low price to a customer to get an order, then putting the normal price on, hoping the customer would not catch it. When the customer did, he said, oh, they changed it on me at inside sales, or somebody on the inside changed it, but I'll issue you a credit. You know, so it was sort of a game he was playing. I had to confront him and, you know, tell him to shape up or ship out type of thing. And if you have a cost to serve model at the line item level, so you have a profit equation, that is, you know, on this line, there was margin dollars. There was some estimated cost to serve dollars for processing this SKU pick line item. And that gives us some amount of, you know, operating profit or lost dollars. So when you have it at that level, you can actually do more detailed dives to find out what's going on. So let's look at how we do that in the next slide here. So here is a report where I've got the top 8 customers out of 11,260 active accounts. It's a distribution chain. And at the very bottom, these are the grand totals. So here's a company that did $134 million in sales for a full year, $42,000 in GP dollars. what we call net before compensation. That's the profit. The only thing to subtract is would be incentive compensation that's allocated at the customer level. But then these next three columns are returns. So, you know, overall for the company, the $134 million in sales, $7 million was canceled out because sales, this was returned. And the GP dollars was reduced by $2.2 million because of the returns. And then you can see that the cost of picking this stuff and shipping it and then returning it and then, you know, a third set of costs, which is to process the paperwork, took off $3.3 million off the NBC total. Now, the next three columns are where we sold stuff below cost. Now, all these columns can be ranked. So in this particular case, we have ranked them by the amount of cost involved in the return. So these are the most expensive return customers. Over here, if we rank by NBC dollars for below cost, we get a very different ranking. And we, you know, you see this, it's a lot of, you know, below cost sales here. But, you know, you're going to find two, three people that are just, you know, you have closeouts and these guys are scavengers, you know. So, or it was a huge mistake, or you had a contract at sell them at a certain price and the price went up and you were stuck with a, you know, an old contract and price. Not that there aren't lessons to be learned from this particular, you know, subset of information. But right now, we're just going to focus on these big return cost customers. And I'll just next slide here. So here is, you know, different case studies. These are all taken out of the Waypoint Analytics, you know, database of distributors that use that cloud service. Type of distributor, credit cost as a percent of operating profit, and then what was their operating profit as a percent of sales? So there's one distributor, huge guy actually, you know, well past north of $1 billion, where they're selling stuff to retailers and their return costs are running at 260% of their operating profit. And of course, their net operating profit is basically a break-even business. Now notice down here at the bottom, here's another customer who sells, wholesaler, who sells to, you know, retail store kind of creatures. And you'll notice that their return costs are negligible, and of course they have a very big operating profit. These people actually do upfront contracting as far as how we are not going to process returns together. Whereas in this case, this particular customer had, you know, two monster accounts. One had zero credit returns, and the other one had intergalactically huge credit returns. So you have to sort of say, well, what are you doing with the best customer, or what's their thinking as far as total cost of closing stuff out as opposed to returning it to you, as opposed to what's going on at the other place. And then you see other kinds of distributors who have in a descending order. Now, at this heating, ventilation, air conditioning, they say, oh, yeah, well, we have warranties, and that's, you know, there's nothing we can do about it. But when you look at the ranking reports, you find out, oh, there are some you know, customers that seem to have proportionally negligible warranties and others are through the roof. Why? What are the root causes? Remember, a lot of, you know, profitability ranking stuff, it takes you out of the, you know, financial numbers are the ultimate downstream aggregated, averaged out, you know, numbers, ultimate symptoms to pay your taxes on time and borrow money from the bank. It has nothing at all to do with, you know, service value innovation, customer profitability, et cetera. And, so as we move upstream to profitability ranking, that still actually is a symptom. We don't necessarily know the actually specific root causes as to why, you know, one customer has huge warranties proportionally and the other one has small ones. So we dig deeper and we find out and we take best practices from one and we sort of help the other guy, you know, do best practices because it's in our interest to both, you know, liquidate unnecessary paperwork processing. And you can see other people here. Now, you notice this electrical industrial guy, he's at 31%. So now what we're going to do is we're going to look at a large electrical distribution chain and look at different operating companies. So I took five of their operating companies that happen to be using the service and looked at their returns as a percent of their NBC And you'll see that there's quite a range here. Also over here, I put below cost. But if you add them together, in other words, what's the hit on operating profit because you do have high returns and or maybe high below cost. So you see one guy's 119. So this is a huge opportunity. I might say that if you went back to, these biggest customers. So if you've got 3.3 million in total return costs, and you're looking at only 8 out of 11,000, and you add these guys up, you find out that, you know, a fraction, I mean, 1% of the customers or less are a huge percent. Now, in fact, I put down here that 20 accounts were by over like about 50% of the total thing. So if you put an analyst, somebody who's sort of a process, you know, thinking kind of person, said flowchart what's going on and flowchart what could happen, and go out there and figure out how to reduce this just in half. I mean, you would pay 10 times that person's salary, and then you'd say, okay, well, what's your next job as far as using analytics to find, you know, just dumb stuff and help turn lose-lose activity costs into win-win savings for both parties. So that's play number six. Now, take a deep breath. We're moving into play number seven, and this is customer niche domination, where you have, in this case, here's a customer wholesaler who's got six locations. He has 3,900 active accounts, and they took them and they put them in different piles. Now, you'll notice that down here, they have 1,600 customers in this one last pile. Basically, these are just small accounts. They just said, and the rest, the bottom 50% of all these little customers. But as they started the top of the report and they put them in different piles, they found out that they had a pile of customers, 149 of them, which is 3.8% of all of their customers, was generating a million in NBC, which is 52% of all their NBC. See, they have a peak NBC of 2 million, and then they start losing money on these different niches. And you'd have to say, well, okay, what's the deal with these 149? And they were shocked. Basically, this particular niche is 100% out of the warehouse business. It had the lowest average margin percent of any of their niches. Now, this is trying to be a tire distributor, and these were municipal truck depot kind of places. So imagine you're in Rochester, New York. You got a lot of snowplow trucks and got recycling trucks and you got garbage trucks, and maybe some of your maintenance and repair and maintenance of your truck fleets you might outsource, but a lot of it's taken care of internally. So it's part of the government monopoly service complex. And tires is a big ticket, so they would put these out on bid. So these were house accounts. They would bid on these things, and they really thought that they would hope to break even. They didn't even know. They just thought, we need to do it to get the volume. We love the volume. It helps move trucks. Our big supplier that, you know, provides these things loves it, et cetera. Hey, maybe the rebate dollars. Who knows? But it was not a crystal clear what's mathematically going on. Because when they mathematically looked at what was going on, it turns out the average order was $8,000. You know, that was at one stop a truck and deliver $8,000 of stuff. So 15% margin, $8,000, that's a lot of margin dollars to cover stopping a truck and sending an invoice and so forth. And it got better because all of this stuff was really indirects, meaning a truckload came in and, you know, 70% of it was tires for, you know, these bids won. It hit the dock and then it would go right out because all these guys would say, all right, we need winter snow tires for our trucks delivered in this 2-week window or whatever. So they were moving in a volume that they could basically not bring it, put it in stock, have it statistically sitting there in case somebody wanted to buy it. So it was really sort of special order stuff routed through the warehouse. So the idea then would be, okay, well, let's go to their extreme. You know, we had, you know, 1,600 things. Mostly these were mom and pop gas stations where mom and pop had two bays and people come in and have a flat tire and they need one passenger tire. And this particular distributor is giving them free delivery twice a day because this was the highest margin percent niche they had. These guys were strictly book price. I mean, 35% margin. You got to be making a lot of money on 35% margin but actually on a $100, you know, tire, that's only $35, and they get these big trucks to stop, et cetera, et cetera. They were losing money on them. And mom and pop would love to sell the business, but they can't because there's ground pollution stuff, and they'd have a huge EPA cleanup. And, you know, better just to sort of have the stop, shut the business down and keep the property forever. Trouble getting kids to come in and do the business and so forth. So they realize, oh my gosh, we're going to have to come up with a different service term package kind of thing for these guys to turn them into profitable accounts or drive them away perhaps to some competitor who wants to give away more service costs and they get a margin dollars. So 12 months later, look what's happened. They've gone, the number one niche, they've gone from 149 customers to 147 because this, although the whole niche is profitable, there were a few that were big losers. And they went out to try to, you know, shape up, ship out the sort of the big losers. And the big losers said, well, we're not going to change and we're going to keep being abusive and buying little emergency stuff from you. So we'll go buy that from a competitor. So they lost a couple, but they went out to the biggest, best, most profitable ones, you know, about five or six of them to get a real sort of, you know, reality check on what was needed and what wasn't. And they found new needs that these guys had that the distributor could readily, invent. It wasn't like something they said, oh, well, we have that, just, you know, order from us. They actually went in and created a California closet replenishment storage system with little barcodes and speed numbers, depending on how easier capable these people were, and gave them their own web page to do order replenishment for all the everyday kind of stuff in addition to the direct bid on the tire. So 12 months later, you can see that the NBC for this niche went up to 1.6 million. That's a 60% increase. And you'll notice down here at the bottom, they were able to reduce the losses from 400,000 in negative NBC to about 2006. So looking at the benefit that they were able to do more and better and reinvent service value for their best niches and figuring out how to shape up or ship out in a way, it wasn't like they fired these guys. They said, here, you know, if you don't want to cooperate, here are the new terms. If they chose to leave, they chose to leave. But the bottom line is total overall NBC went from 2 million to 3.1 internally. And you can see that that's about where we break even here. So their peak internal NBC was here. The final NBC was 2.8 versus 1.2. So that's more than 100% increase in their net before compensation. And basically, it's tantamount to operating profit. So that's an example of putting guys in piles that are similar, finding out peculiar but similar needs that niche has, provided it, invented it, and then they say, wow, I love you because you're doing something no one else is. So this is sort of summarizes the recipe. Up here, this YT stands for YouTube. So if you went to YouTube and searched for my name, Bruce Merrifield, plus playlists, you're going to see 9 different playlists with about, I don't know, 400 different, you know, 4-minute clips. It's like 31 hours of elapsed stuff. Playlist 4 is just on nicheonomics, and there are 57, you know, 4-minute clips on that. And so you really want to do a deep dive on this, you're welcome to do that. But you have to know what is your number one historically most profitable niche pile. Then you go out to your 5 most profitable and or progressive customers in the niche. And you got to visit them. You got to go out there and you got to have somebody that, you know, can do this. I mean, most feel like they just don't have the curiosity, the peripheral vision to go out and understand things. But basically, when you go out and you say, hey, well, you know, why do you buy from us? What do? You know, tell me stories of things that we or other people have done that have upset you. They have slowed you down. They have cost you downtime. They have cost you lack of productivity, or it's just frustration. You know, it's paper accumulating because we're not doing so. Tell me stories that bother you. You listen carefully, and the opposite of that story is a service insight, and there's a metric in that, an innovation metric. So once you figure that out, you can go back to the team and say, look, here's a target niche. These 5 customers sort of are faces. They personify, they crystallize the abstraction of niche to these kinds of customers. And they told me, voice of the customer, that these eight metrics add up to great service excellence. And frankly, we've not measured any of them very well. And some of them we haven't even thought of. We just give everybody the same old service experience and same old service metrics. This is a chance to, you know, take our service value proposition to a next level. And then you put that into effect and you start to measure everything and you get there and the rest is history. So the goal here is you want to tie everyone's mind. You get it? These are the people that pay all your wages. And, you know, you got to love these guys and do heroic extra efforts for them because this is how it's going to pay off for you in gain sharing. And then if you focus on these metrics for the team, gross profit dollars per FTE, full-time equivalent employee, profit dollars per FTE, and therefore how much out of that is gain sharing per employee, they all go up. This will go up because you improve the fill rate effectiveness for that niche. You can't have, you know, the best one-stop shop in-stock fill rates for everybody on the planet. But for one niche, you can actually tune those fill rates for that niche to be much better. Then because your service is so excellent, they start to call you first or they start to buy everything from you, and that builds average order size, average, you know, stop, you know, volume per customer, average volume per sales call, et cetera. So when GP dollars goes up by 50%, profit dollars go up fourfold because when I stop a truck and I'm delivering 20, 30, 40, 50% more margin dollars per stop of the truck, or I'm processing paperwork and for every three-way match I do for receivables, you know, I've got 50% more margin dollar in that activity. When I'm taking a line of inside sales, I'm taking a line item, and I've got 50% more dollars per line item. All these people just got more productive, but their activity doesn't change. Their activity cost for that stop of the truck, the three-way paper match, the entering an order for a customer inside sale doesn't change. And so that flows through to the bottom line. There's order size economic, you know, flow through that then allows you to make premium profits out of which you can pay gain sharing. So the customer's winning, the employees are winning, the suppliers are winning because you're growing your business faster because everybody wants to buy from you and you're getting a bigger share of that niche. And the shareholders are winning because you're making, you know, a lot of profits out of which you can pay gain sharing and still have profits. So this is sort of a summary of basically competitive strategy. Here you are. You figure out who your number one target customer niche is. Somebody goes out and does field research, a little anthropology, whatever. They come back and they say, hey, everybody in the little box, you know, here are eight metrics that these guys want. Now, some customers, everybody wants zero errors. Everybody wants on-time delivery, but not everybody wants the same response time. Everybody wants one-stop shop in-stock fill rates, but obviously each niche is going to have a different, you know, mix of items in that formula. So by working hard and co-creating, in a sense, the big eight of service excellence, we can then go out and say, hey, here's what we've got, and here are the benefits of how it lowers your costs, improves your uptime, productivity, et cetera. And then what happens, they say this error is reversed. Actually, they would start to buy more stuff from us. Now, a year later, your competitors are going to go out and say, hey, dude, didn't you used to buy a lot from us? Oh, yeah, well, I switched to these guys because they have the big eight of service excellence. They have unconditional guaranteed zero errors on-time delivery. These guys say, oh, we couldn't do that. Our people don't want to change. They're all in their little silos. They're doing what they're doing and doing so forth. How about if we cut the price? So that's basically what their competitive response is going to be 18 months later. So now the target customer says to you, hey, I love you and everything else, but look at the price from Dirtball Supply. Here's last look. And that's when you say, well, I'm glad you brought that up because we have proven that our service value package has improved your productivity so much that actually we should be charging you more. Where's our fraction of that incremental bottom line action we've created for you? Oh, and realize that, of course, they can't get basic service brilliance from these guys. They go, well, gee, how about if we just sort of kept the contract the same type of thing? But now you have something no one else has. Everybody else has got the product. Everybody else can sell price. But the whole, you know, package of service value they don't have. And this just little notation says this is specifically YouTube playlist number 4, clip number 16. These are just, this is clip 17. these are just sort of listing guidelines for how to go out there and discern what the peculiar important service metric or two is for each niche that you go after. You know, for those people who are contractor supply distributors, a universal is what I call uptime ratio. So if a contractor said, all right, I'm going to take the number of hours I bill per week, and I'm going to divide by the total payroll hours for my people that are actually doing labor, what's that number? And if you're a contractor who's doing a lot of repair, breakdown maintenance, remodeling, whatever, you know, about 50% is about an average. But if you've got basic service brilliance that allows them to have more uptime and less downtime for lack of not having what they need, you get this up to about 70%, which is a huge impact as far as how much you can pay your laborers, how much you make as a for operating profit. And of course, the flip side of it is if you're doing, you know, you're going to a job and you've got what you need and you get the job done on time, you get to the next job on time. The customer, the first customer is getting great service, the second service is getting timely arrival of a perfect job type of thing. So every customer says, hey, these guys are good. I'm going to keep using them and I'm going to tell my friends. So their business starts to grow with a new profitable uptime ratio. Now, you know, I sort of glossed over the idea of, okay, you come back and tell everybody in your company, this is our number one niche. Here are five faces on the wall who are our number, you know, represent our most profitable customers. You might put another five up and say, and these are the five biggest, best customers who, you know, we're not number one with, and they're going to be our target accounts. And and then here are eight numbers. So we're going to figure out how we're going to, well, how are we going to do that? Oh, we can, well, you know, I'm sorry. You're going to have to invent more or less, better or less, you know, systems for, and, you know, how you're going to measure these things and use feedback and figure out root causes for why you're screwing stuff up, et cetera, to get those errors from 70 per thousand items down to five or two or three and have an unconditional guarantee, et cetera. You know, the key to service level is you have happy employees, and if they're happy, they stay. And the longer they stay, even by osmosis, they get better at what they're doing. That's mastery. And the better I am at something, the more I enjoy it. And as I stay and I get better, then service improves. As service improves, even you might get to the point for doing it right the first time and having unconditionally guaranteed, then I'm happy because I give the best service in the industry. I've got pride, customers love me, et cetera. When you have improving service, then customers are happy. So your sales guy walks into account and the customer says, I cannot believe how your people saved my ass, bah, 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 bah. I mean, compared to the competition, you guys are awesome. That is far more motivating to a sales guy than anything else you can do, as opposed to you walk in and you can reverse all these. Grumpy employees turn over. The more they turn over, the less they know. The more the service deteriorates, the more the customers get upset, the more demotivated the salespeople are. So we want to get virtuous cycles, not vicious cycles, going all the way down to happier customers, stay with us, buy more, tell their friends, et cetera. They may give us last look, but we'll get last look an extra point or two because they agree that we are the best service value, even though, you know, best total value at a little bit higher price. And this allows us to grow faster and more profitably than the average bear in the industry. And when that happens, that allows everybody to get promoted from within, have job security, job pride, and so forth, and that all adds up to happy employees. But it starts with, you know, you've got to hire the right attitude and aptitude. You got to get the right athlete for this game. And so high-performance companies like Costco or FedEx or L.L. Bean, they pay the most to get the most to expect even more. So, you know, that allows you to have a high-performance culture. But, you know, you are what you are and where you are. So how do you bootstrap your way and transform from we pay average wages to get average people to have average service, and therefore we've got a commodity and we've got to be a price matcher. We can't be a dominant player. How do you migrate to that? So you might check out YouTube playlist 430, and then I've got an entire playlist on, you know, creating the high performance culture, et cetera. But another shortcut might be to go to my website, Merrifield Act 2. That's just the number. Merrifieldact2.com, and download what I call my core customer renewal roadmap. Once you have service excellence, that allows you to get last look and then get a little bit more and or pivot into sort of a partnering process. So most distributors are find out they go out and they've got there's always another competitor. Sometimes there are two. You know, and back in the 60s, it was very, purchasing 101 said, look, you always have two suppliers to play them off against when they're in check prices because they're always trying to sneak the prices up. So they want to sell high, we're going to buy low, and we're going to beat them up and do a better job than they sell high. So, and if you're really big, then you can actually have a third guy, you know, where you give them enough volume to keep them on the hook. And now you got three guys in the game, and that's cool. It also used to be cool because back in the 60s, you still had allocation shortages, and you needed to, beat these guys up to try to get X allocation. That's gone now. We have a global excess supply of everything, equally excellent product. So if you're selling products transactionally, and you want to be a pal to an old school buyer and, hopefully, the senior guy ahead of you retires, so you move up to number one, sort of play the long-term attrition game of, quote, relationships. Periodically, the customers will say, well, look, times are tough, blah, 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 here's last look, got to sharpen your pencil. How are they say, hey, it's time to chisel, get a little more competitive here. That's where you could say, well, great. Thanks for last look, but because we have proven in your face service excellence unconditionally guaranteed, and we've talked about and measured how your uptime, all these hidden soft costs have actually improved, evaporated, disappeared. That's why, at the minimum, I get last look, and I get extra point for me, the rep, and because I'm the one that made it all happen, and an extra point for the horse I'm riding. You may be worth five more points, but at least you can get, last look plus 2 points, and that might be real salesmanship. And point out that you're still, even though you pay a higher price, you're still getting the best total procurement value, the best total procurement cost system value. Oh, yeah, I get that, but psychologically, price is price and wah, wah, wah type of thing. Well, okay, look, I wouldn't be opposed to meeting this price, but what are you going to do for me? Quid pro quo. It's got a bad name from politics, but basically it's like, hey, you give me something, I'll give you something, and maybe 1 + 1 = 3 or 4. We could actually create some synergy here and point out that you may have customers who don't even buy as much total volume, and they enjoy lower prices, but because of their average order size and their average order pick, perhaps, the total cost to serve as a percent of the volume, sales volume to the customer, is lower. So if they can work with you to lower cost to serve, then out of that reduction in service costs, you can actually split those savings with them in the form of a price. So what you're really saying is, look, I could give you a lower price, but you could give me more volume. You could take the same volume and order half as often, twice as much. But there's probably more friction in the replenishment system. So if you would like, I'll have my team come out here with our new analytics for your specific buying pattern, find friction, figure out how to reduce that, so you can save hidden activity costs and you can get a lower price. Do you want my team to come out and do that? We'll talk more about that in a subsequent webinar. This gets into quoting, where the if you look at this is a customer whale curve for strictly direct orders. So you take all the customers who buy direct orders, and you just take that portion, and you figure out the NBC of them, and you say, what's the number one most profitable NBC customer on direct orders? And you put their NBC going up the y-axis. And across the x-axis, you take the number two guy. And maybe 11,000 customers, but 500 of them had a direct order during the year. So there'll only be about 500 in this particular thing. But notice that it explodes up and it levels off. I mean, this is a perfect whale curve. There really isn't, you probably can't see it. There's probably a tiny little, we had a direct ship of $100 and all the paperwork costs easily exceeded the margin dollars. But you can see it's massively profitable. In fact, you can't see it, but it's about $15 million in NBC, this line up here. And if you look at these categories for this particular customer, you can see that the direct is giving them 15.6 in NBC. When they deliver stuff on their truck, presumably out of their warehouse, they make a little bit of money. when they ship a common carrier out of their warehouse, they make a little money. And down here, customer pickup and will call. This is a contractor supply distributor. So when you find one area where you make just a ton of money, you go, oh my God, that's a bright spot. why? And then once you get there, why don't we do it 20% better and pump the seed out even further? So that's bright spot management. So this is, you know, the branches that this big chain has. And you can see that the different branches, they've got, I don't know, 8 or 9 branches here, overall 6,200 customers. You can see that this branch makes a lot of money and these branches lose money. And when you've got a lot of customers and you're losing money, you would suspect that that's probably a huge counter will call, small order, lots of return kind of a business. And then if you strip out the directs, see here in this particular one, the top thing here, we're giving credit, you know, for the direct shipments to the customers that they have. When you strip it out and you're strictly looking at warehouse, the headquarters stocking location makes money, but actually everybody else is losing money. And this is very typical. People love margin percent. So you get all excited about house accounts at 35% margin, not realizing that their order size is so small and returns and so forth, you're getting killed. And up here you're going, oh, these are directs. You can't make much money at 15, 16, 17%, when in fact, you know, 15% of a $10,000 order, you know, with just paperwork exchange and trade credit risk is really very profitable. So if that's super profitable, how do we do a better job? Well, you know, within Waypoint, you can actually go look at, you know, different rankings and find out that of all the customers that buy directly, 0.1% generate 33% of those direct profits on 15% of the direct bids. That business involved only 0.1% of the vendors on 0.25% of the SKUs. So in a Venn diagram, it's like, okay, who are the customers? What are they buying from what vendors, you know, and how are they doing it right here? And let's do a deep dive and say, how could we do that better? You know, just 20% better. And so would you go out and interview the best one fraction of the most profitable customers and say, well, thank you very much for the business and how's it going and how's the whole process look and where are gaps and, you know, how can we speed this up or make things easier for you or increase your productivity in some way? And, you know, you'll find stuff because no one's ever been out there to ask those questions and look at it from a system, particularly from a, you know, if your customer has estimators and from the time they're asked to bid for their customer, if you could collapse the amount of time that it takes for them to get the bid by 80%, not cut it in half, like, okay, thanks for the inquiry, we'll get back to you in 4 days, you get back to in 1 day. I promise you, their sales and volume will go up just because speed wins, and you're gonna, you know, you're gonna be sharing and enjoying that business. So holistically, how do you work with the customer and your vendors to speed that entire process up is just one idea. So at any rate, you go out and you know, visit these guys and say, well, let's, you know, wave a wand and imagine there's, you know, time and there's money, whatever, it's not even an issue. What would be the dream scenario? And then you have to figure out how you can approximately invent it, make it happen. Here's a case where industrial buyers, I went out to visit with them and I said, well, you know, what honks you off? And they said, well, you know, I call you up and it takes you 1, 2, 3, 4 days to get back to me with a price and availability to, you know, shipping date to receive this stuff, 8, 10, 12 weeks out, maybe in some cases. And I just want to get the paper off my desk. Oh, so you want fast quotes. How about if you called in the morning and we got back to you in the afternoon? Oh, that'd be awesome. And then another problem was, and this is back in, you know, pre-database, you know, kind of world, where they said, you know, when one of my people in the plant calls up and says, when is, you know, this particular product going to arrive so we can schedule people to, you know, do something with the product? I got to search and hunt for it. I said, well, what if we gave you this sort of a super duper summary report? And they went, oh, that would be great. So it got to the point where we were cranking out about 150 of these reports twice a month, but the report didn't work unless you gave us 100% of all your direct business. And so between fast quotes, get paper off the desk and get, you know, making their life easier, they just gave us all the business and didn't really care about the price in a way. So, and then on top of that, you may say, what are additional best practices for the quoting division? Because we, you know, it's a cash cow. I mean, it's a phenomenal thing. So, but, you know, keep a log, of, you know, customers and how long it took us and so forth, very quickly, within 20, 30, 40 entries, you're going to start to see patterns that pop out. You're going to find people that always call you for bid and never give you an order. How are you going to deal with those people? You're going to find more innovation metrics so that you can actually get more NBC, net profit, net before compensation for time spent or bids, quotes, and so forth. Your batting averages are going to go up, and you're going to find experiments to do. So summary and direct quoting, because distribution channels are margin percent myopic, they just assume that high margin percent is profitable and low margin percent is not so profitable. That allows you to lose money on counter business. That allows you to make enormous money on directs. So look at the total profit equation and exploit that vis-a-vis, you know, the mindset of your competitors. Do smart experiments in bright spots, wherever you make all your money. That would be, you know, not your number one niche of customers or direct business, and specifically the most profitable customers that you're quoting for on the most profitable SKUs with the most profitable vendors. Or simply put, when you have a whale curve, the huge leverage of cost savings or profit winnings are at the extremes of the whale curve. All the stuff in the middle is, you know, that's another day and down the road. So that's about it. On summary thoughts, credit costs is sort of an easy slam dunk. And you can put one analyst on there and get huge savings for both you and the customer, which is a value you're providing for them. And maybe you can turn that into getting more business out of them. Fast quoting, we've talked about that. Best service value for one most net profitable niche at a time is tougher, but it's a sustainable profit power machine solution. I mean, the day you want to say, you know what, we have 100 customers in our number one most profitable niche, and we own them. We're doing stuff that no one else is doing. They love it. And so that's why we systematically, repetitively are getting a stream of large average margin dollar per transaction orders. The key is to have more margin dollar per transaction than cost to serve per transaction, which gives you profit per transaction, and then have a lot of them. And so when you can build that kind of a flow from 100 customers, that's like little oil wells, just pumping out a couple barrels of profitable oil every day. Of course, to make these things happen, who's going to be your champion and or team that's going to make these things happen? We'll get to onto more plays in webinar number 6. So that's your drink from the fire hose for today, and I'll see you at webinar number 6. Thank you very much.